Hey, welcome to episode 5 of the Going Deeper podcast. My name is Ravi. I'm the director of Next Generation Ministries here at Good News Gathering. And joining us today for this episode is Jeff.
Good morning.
JD.
What up?
And Wayne, again, hello. We're happy to have him back with us. So full disclosure, we are recording this ahead of time. And part of that is Jeff has been doing double, triple duty even sometimes as a lawyer and a judge in our community, and which is very not threatening at all in the office to know you have a lawyer and a judge as boss. But he's actually... by the time you're listening to this, he'll be an active judge sitting on a bench, and so we're grateful to have a man of God that does that and how God uses him for that. But sometimes we got to work multiple jobs, and it's been part of what has made G&G successful for these past 20 years is a commitment to do whatever it takes inside and outside this building to make it keep going, and we know that the church is not the ministry center; it is the people of God, and so we're just. We're just talking about generosity. And so, again, by the time you're listening this past weekend, Jeff, you delivered a message about going generously. And while we won't talk about the points necessarily of that, why do you think when it comes to a money series, we kind of joke like attendance will drop off, we don't invite friends, we won't have new people because we're talking about money. And I guess there's two sides to that question of one, that why are we so sensitive about money and talking about that? And two, what would you say to somebody who says, that church only wants my money, church at large, like they only care about my money? What would you say in response to that?
Well, I guess the first thing I would say is if that's their impression, there's a chance that they got it honestly. I was talking to a pastor friend of mine a while back, and he said, you know, Jeff, he said, I actually sat down and thought about how many times we took up an offering at our church in a month. And their church, it does Sunday morning, Sunday night, Wednesday night. And he said, you know, we take up an offering in Sunday school class, and then we take an offering up during the worship service. We take up an offering Sunday night. We take up an offering Wednesday. And when we have a missionary in, we take up a love offering. And he went on, he said, I counted up in a month, we had taken up 50 offerings. And then he made a classic statement I've never forgotten. And he said, it's no wonder my people feel like they're getting fleeced. And sometimes I think churches have come at it in really a very negative fashion. And it's about, well, we need your money. The church needs your money. When in reality, if we follow the God of the universe, he does not need our money to accomplish his will on this earth. It's really the total opposite. You and I need to give. We need to become a generous people. And when you think about it, throughout the Bible, from beginning to end, you see God as the giver, the Bible says, of every good and perfect gift. From the very beginning, I mean, he gives us the universe in which we live. He gives us our bodies and our talents and our gifts, and all that we have really goes back to him. And I think if we can get that idea in our minds that God is the giver of everything and that we are simply possessors, not owners, the whole game changes for us.
That's a really good point. Wayne, let me kick this to you. How do you think somebody, maybe you don't, so you can think about it, but how do you think somebody changes their perspective on that, to what Jeff was saying, that God is the giver of everything, it's not mine anyways, and how would they begin that?
Well, I mean, it's a process. It's something you just don't learn in one day, and I think it comes from when you change from being, and we live in a society that's an inward-focused society. And God's saying he wants us to be outward focused. And once we turn our attention from what I think I perceive I got to have to those around me, like I seeing the needs in those around me, when you become an outward focused person, you start giving, then you become more like God, because God is a giving God, as Jeff said. In the class series in 201, we teach about, you know, the giving, and it's one of the things we talk about is God gave first. God gave his son. I mean, he gave the ultimate gift in his son. He gave. And it's been proven throughout history that those who are outward focused, and that's G&G's motto, we want to be an outward focused church, an outward focused person, you have less stress. You have more joy in your life because you're focused on those around you. When you become very inward focused, things just tend to pile up on you. So to me, it's a process. It's about listening to the series that's coming up. It's about maybe reading a book on giving. And it's about adopting that personality that I need to be a giving person because that's what God wants me to be, is that person who is giving of my time, my talent, the things that he is. We're just stewards. Like you said, we're stewards of this. And it's a thing that we struggle with. And I'll be honest with you, it's times I struggle with, you know, we talked earlier, if we come on it, I worked and my hours and my, you know, it's God is given all this stuff. So it's a process, learning process.
Yeah. And I think to realize that that's a process in a lot of spiritual areas will help us the incremental, okay, I will get there. I don't have to get there today, but to be moving towards that. JD, what do you think about people say, well, if God doesn't need my money, but I certainly do, right?
Sure.
But it's my money. Shouldn't I be able to decide how I do that?
Well, that is a challenging question, I think, because certainly God gives us talents and abilities that we can use to make money and things of that nature. But you know, I encourage people sometimes when I'm talking to them to run everything backward. Okay, where did that money come from? Well, I earned it. How did you earn it? With, you know, by going to work. Okay, how did you get that job? Well, I went to college and I worked hard and I got the grades and I, you know, got the job. Okay, well, what gave you the ability to do that? And you could just kind of work it all the way back. And when you get to the end, whether you're talking about, you know, the work ethic that was taught to you in your family or even the natural skills and abilities you have, all of those came from somewhere. Those of us who follow Christ believe that they came from God because he is the ultimate creator of all life. And so from the very beginning, every single thing around us, every person in our lives is a gift from God. And so when we recognize that, I do think it opens up our mind to be a little bit more generous because you have this perspective of, you know what, even the things I think I earned are really the result of previous gifts that were unearned. You know, the things that I have and that I worked really hard to attain are still the result of gifts that, you know, to some degree or another, I didn't make myself have. You know, I think that's a really important thing to think about. You know, this kind of came into focus for me a little bit because my wife and I just paid off our mortgage. It's a super exciting moment for us. You know, we invested a lot of time and energy into working really, really hard so that we could get out of debt, like entirely out of debt. And when we achieved that, it was like this big, huge, this house is ours. And from a purely American economic sense, that is the absolute truth. We own that piece of property and the house on it. However, the abilities that she has to be a dental hygienist than I have to work in the church, all of those came from God. The motivation to get up every day and to work really hard. You know, there are some days where me selfishly on the human level maybe don't have that motivation. Maybe I'm not interested in getting up out of bed and working really hard, but God prods me and reminds me of the importance of what I'm doing. That's a gift from God. All of those things roll together and you realize, man, everything I have truly is a blessing and a gift from the God who gives every good thing.
Yeah, and I think to realize it's a gift plays into last week's message about realizing God's given us gifts. And some of us, it is money. I mean, we all to realize that. And I think, Jeff, you gave a statistic about if you own a car, before when we were setting up.
Yeah. If you own a car, you own something that 92% of the people in this world do not own. I mean, we're fortunate to be a part of this culture that we live in. Now, the thing about our culture though, is we are a capitalist free market society. Now, there's tremendous upside to that because, you know, that kind of an economic framework requires a certain sense of responsibility and accountability, and those are good things. You know, God put two people in the garden and said, tend the garden. And so work and working hard is good. But there's also a potential downside to that because a lot of us feel like, you know what, I pulled myself up by my own bootstraps. I made this money. I did this. This is mine. And a lot of times we are kind of like small children who are clutching something very tightly and saying, this is mine. And in reality, it's not. We have it by the grace of God. And if we can wrap our minds around that, it will change our entire perspective on our possessions and our money and whatever it is that we have. And we'll begin to see ourselves as possessors or stewards, people who have this and God's given it to us to use for his glory. And that's really the bottom line.
Yeah, we can get to a place where we think God is just here to bless me. He's this cosmic ATM or genie, right? And then if I say the right words and do the right things, then God will have to. He'll feel compelled to give me what I asked for. That's not Christianity. That's actually magic, you know? So, and so to realize that it is a learning to live in contentment, to live below our means. And that is so difficult because we live in a culture that is saying more, more, more all the time. Years ago, I remember taking a mission trip, taking our youth group to Nashville, and we were serving with this mission. I don't remember the name. And the guy took all this time. He pulled one of our kids up, and he's like, hold out your arms. And he loaded him up with food, like, you know, box after box and can. And he's holding all the kids standing there awkwardly, his arms huge, just carrying all this food. And he says, do you know how much all this food costs us? And we're like, no, what? You know, we're totally, you know, involved now. He said, $1. $1 can buy all this food. And we're like, whoa, you know? And he said, and we just have to pray and believe that God will provide that. I'm like, yeah, we're with him. And he goes, and then he goes, and then God's going to give me a Bentley. And I'm like, wait, what? And it just totally shifted. And he starts talking about how, you guys see that Mercedes that was out there when you came in? I'm like, yeah, it was an older Mercedes. And he goes, well, God gave me that. And I know now he's going to give me a Bentley. And I just want to be like scratching my head. I'm thinking, we'll clean up in theology aisle 4 tonight, you know, yeah, with our kids. But I'm just thinking that we're missing the point. Like, God is not here to just give me a better life now, but to use what I have for his glory and his purposes and to be open to that. So definitely some interesting thoughts on that. So I guess, Jeff, if I can just direct you, because here at Good News Gathering, we have maybe a different perspective on money and what leadership knows. And our listeners may or may not be aware of that, but you have dedicated to that you will not know what somebody gives. You don't look at the role, as it were, of percentages that people are giving. So you don't know week in and week out. It's a pretty quiet, private matter of who knows. And to the point that even our treasurer and accountant don't feed into leadership decisions. Am I correct on that? Because of, I mean, they may guide, but they're not going to say, hey, this person gave this much and therefore we should listen to them. I guess speak to that and kind of the decision process that went behind that with you and the leadership team to decide that.
Well, very, very early in our church's history, we made a decision that we would not pass a plate down the rows. We felt that and studies indicate that one of the greatest concerns that people have that don't normally go to church is they feel that the church is just out for their money. And we wanted to play against that as much as we could. And so we made a decision very early on that we wouldn't pass a plate, but that we would teach on generosity. And we teach on it regularly. We probably teach on it actually more than most churches do, because we hit it in class 201. We always do a lesson series on it each year. But we made the decision very early on that nobody on staff not just me, but no staff member and nobody on the leadership team would know the identities of people who give here at Good News. And we made that decision because we wanted, especially for me, to be in a position to be able to teach on the subject without anybody in the audience looking back and thinking, he knows I don't give. And we also made the decision that anybody who works with the financial, with our financial part of our organization, who actually has access to the identifiers, would not have any kind of a voting role on the leadership team. Because what we didn't want is we didn't want somebody being able to walk into a leadership team meeting and say, well, if you make this decision, so-and-so, who gives a lot of money, is not going to be happy. We weren't going to have that. Because here, decisions need to be made based on, is this where we believe God is leading us, not is this going to affect our bottom line financially. That cannot become the decider of what decisions we make. And so that's kind of how we got to that point. And frankly, it's worked very well. It reduces a ton of pressure when we teach on this subject.
Yeah. And I think even that, I think about, there's times I've been in church and, you know, somebody saying, well, if you do that, I'm going to take my money. And I didn't even know that to begin with. Right. And that we can view money again as such, as a tool, right? But we can view it in such a bad way to say, I'm going to hold this ransom until you do my bidding. And the nice thing about the health of G&G is that's unlikely to happen, because you're not even going to know that somebody's going to go. Not saying it can't, but it's unlikely that that's going to influence the decision of what you're making with that. And so I guess with this too, in thinking about people saying, well, I have money, I have more value, we get into that we think, oh, we're better, right? I'm more blessed because I have money. And we can look at it and go, no, I don't really think that. But maybe it's just me, and I can show my cards there. Sometimes I get into that where I'm thinking, God's blessed me because now, you know, how are things going? Oh, I'm blessed. Bank account's full. I'm good. Right. And the things go wrong. I go, God, you know, what'd I do? Right? and we can think, but God's not malice in that way. He's not angry at us. Why do you think we assign value based on wealth and money in our culture, or even just maybe that's humans?
I think it's humans. I don't think it's just our culture, because Jesus dealt with it. In his day, it was a common belief that if you were poor or you were ill, that you were not blessed by God. And I think that's been common since probably not long after creation. It's just part of the human condition. We have this tendency to compare ourselves with others. And if we're better off, then we're blessed. If we're worse off, we're not as blessed as the other guy. And it's just it's part of the fact that we live in a fallen world. And I think Satan uses that against us.
Yeah, and Jesus actually had some things to say about money. He was not quiet on this. And it's interesting, because there are some issues that Jesus didn't talk about. And we go, well, Jesus didn't talk about it, it didn't matter to him. But then there's issues he did clearly talk about, and we go, oh, I don't want to listen to him, you know? But when you come down to it, this idea that money can be a master, and it can master you, or you can control it. And Jesus was very clear that you cannot serve two masters. You cannot serve God and money. Again, I don't think that was an indictment on wealth as much as the attitude behind it, because the word he's using there is talking about the spirit of greed behind that. And so I guess as I think about that, I realize that, well, it doesn't matter where I am in life, I need to commit to being generous. And my wife and I say something back and forth whenever we're feeling a little stingy sometimes, you know, and saying we're never too broke to be generous. And JD, you had brought up the widow's mites, that maybe if our listeners aren't familiar with that story.
So there's this story where Jesus is sitting in the temple courts, and he and his disciples are watching people give to kind of the offering area. So they had an area set up in the temple where where the people would come in and drop off their offering. And they're seeing these people walk up and dropping in loads of money. And then they see this widow come walking up, and the Bible indicates that she had these two small copper coins and she tosses them in. And Jesus turns to his disciples. He draws their attention to this. And he says, "Do you see this woman?" And they're like, "Yeah, yeah." And he's like, "She's given more than all the others because she gave out of her poverty. All the rest have given out of their abundance." In other words, there's this moment where Jesus recognizes there's a sacrificial call upon us in the idea of generosity. And it comes right back from Jesus. You think about Jesus. Jesus is the example of the ultimate sacrifice, someone who's willing to die on our behalf to give us the opportunity to have that relationship with that saving relationship with God. And similarly, when we are generous, there's a kind of a minimum sacrificial level to which we have to give of ourselves on behalf of others in order to kind of be generous in a way that Jesus has would look at and say, that's a gift worth giving. You know, I find it fascinating that Jesus didn't run up to that woman and say, no, you don't have to do that. I mean, he went on to say, she has given the very last, she's given everything she had, and he didn't stop her. You know, and the reason is because A, he's God, and B, he knows he'll take care of her. All right, and so often we approach life through this lens of, if I give this away, I will not have that. If I give this, I can't have that. If I give this much, if I give to this point that it hurts, there's no way I'll be able to take care of these other things. And I'm not saying that any of those other things are illegitimate or that they're problematic or that they're just the sign of American capitalistic culture. No, I mean, having a house, having a car, having clothes, you know, taking care of your kids, paying for an education. These things are good and important. But when we say, I cannot give sacrificially, I cannot give till it hurts, because if I do, then this won't happen. We are cutting off at the knees the faith that God has called us to place in him, where if we feel that tug to give at some really kind of almost ridiculous level, and we know, I mean, we're not faking ourselves, we're not going over the top, but we know God has called us to this, and we say, you know what, God, nope, sorry, can't do that. We have limited our faith. And we have limited that relationship that we have with Christ. And I can just honestly say this. I am a living, breathing example of someone who has tried, and not perfectly and certainly failingly in many areas, but I've tried to apply these principles. And there have been moments where I know that there is no way that should have happened. That bank account should not look like that. Or God has taken care of other things in my life that not financial things, but he's taken care of other things or protected me from other things that maybe wouldn't have happened had I not been in that mode where I was willing to trust him with the things that you know were kind of scary or crazy sounding or whatever. So to me, it's, you know, It's are we willing to be generous as he was generous? Are we willing to be sacrificial as he was sacrificial? And if so, we can assume that he will provide.
Yeah, and I think I've always called it the scandalous generosity, because the rest of the world looks at it and goes, that doesn't make any sense. Why would you do that? Right? And so much like the widow giving kind of her last two coins, and that if we realize that, you know, whatever percentage it is that we would say a tithe 10%, but that God can use more with the 10% that I give than I can if I just keep the whole 100%. And to realize that if I commit myself to scandalous generosity, that God is committed to taking care of me the same way he does with the flowers and the sparrow, and you can go back to Jesus teaching.
And I think Robbie, I think you are absolutely right, because that passage, you know, is talking about not worrying. He's saying you don't have to worry about this. You do not have to worry about this. You do not have to worry about your life. You do not have to worry about your family. If you focus on ensuring the blessing and the care and the concern for other people, I will take care of you. And that is so difficult for us to do. It really is.
Well, and I think that's the beauty of the very end of that passage where he says, if you seek first the kingdom of God and his righteousness, all these things will be added to you. And that's really where our focus has to be. And that's true whether you're the rich person that's putting all that money in the plate that Jesus watched or that poor widow. It's not rich is bad and poor is good. I don't think that's it at all. It's where's your heart? That's the bottom line.
And it goes back to what you're saying. It's when we give that, we think, well, if we give this, we're going to live it. No, we're not going to live that. We're given this that God can take whatever I give and multiply that into people's lives. It's not what we're missing. It's what we're gaining because of what people's lives are going to be changed. And Jeff, you said earlier before we come on, that 10%, to me, it should be maybe a starting point. Mm-hmm. You know, it doesn't have to be the end all. I've given my 10% and we're done. You know, and I forget the author who wrote the book. I see his face on TV, but he wrote a book. It was a number one seller for years. And he did what he ended up doing was being a reverse tither because he had got millions of dollars from the book sale.
He says, Rick Warren.
Yeah, Rick Warren.
That's right.
And he became a reverse tither. He says, I don't need, what am I going to do with this 90% of millions? So he was a reverse tither, which means he only kept the 10% and gave away the 90%. And you know, John Wesley's the same way. When John Wesley, who helped found the Methodist Church, passed away, when things started to grow, and he just kept enough that when he passed away, he took care of his expenses. I mean, that's the mentality I think that God wants us to have. It's what he's going to do with that he's going to multiply it. And a few years ago, up at the Festival of Bells, I had an opportunity to witness a modern-day widow's mite. As you know, they asked the pastors to go around and we take collection buckets to start for the next year. And as I walked by,
yeah, I've never felt comfortable with that since we don't do that here.
Well, I didn't either, but till this. So I'm walking down with a bucket and I go by this one lady and she's sitting there in a pair of old raggedy jeans and an old T-shirt and she's, wait a minute, sir. So I stop and she reaches in her pocket and she drops in the bucket. A little bit of change, and there's some lint and some dirt coming out with the change. And she looks at me and says, sir, isn't much, but it's all I've got. I thought, there's a lady who got the biggest blessing that night of anybody that was there, because without that, she wouldn't have got, without people funding that and people tithing that and churches giving to that, she never would get to experience that set in that setting and experience that God took that and blessed her beyond measure, and of course bless my life too, because this is real, you know. So giving, I mean, being outward focused.
Yeah, and I think to focus on the what's the exact percentage always felt a little bit like when teenagers ask me, well, how far is too far with my girlfriend, right? And I'm like, we're asking the wrong question about like holiness and that. And so what we see Jesus doing is setting up this, you've heard it said, but I tell you, right? So you've heard it said refers to the law. You know the law says this, but I tell you, and then he goes above and beyond. So you've heard it said, don't kill. I tell you, if you even think about somebody like you're going to kill them, you've already done that. You've heard it said, don't commit adultery. I tell you, if you even look at a woman with lust in your eyes, you've already committed, right? So he like raises the bar and everybody's like, oh, Jesus is so gracious and so kind. Like he changed everything. He actually made it more stringent. The law just pointed out how messed up I was. Jesus like made it about the heart. I can't do enough. And so when we say, well, how much should I give? Well, the Old Testament, it was a 10%. The New Testament, now we see a pattern of generosity that's well beyond that. You just have to look at the church in Acts, and they're selling everything they have to the point that people are trying to fake that, and they pay for it. Acts 5, they pay for it with their lives. But the point is, they're trying to get in on the action. Because that, oh man, that looks awesome. I want that. And they try to fake that. And it goes pretty poorly for them. So, but the reality is the call now of Christianity, if we understand that it's not mine, it's all God's, then the call is to go above and beyond that. And that's why, again, I come back to its scandalous generosity. The rest of the world's going to look at it and just go, that makes no sense why you do that.
It's funny, I think to some degree or another, may you not get as far ahead as a follower of Jesus if you really commit to it and do what he's calling you to do. May your bank account never quite swell to the heights you had hoped, or maybe, yeah. I mean, may your 401k not be quite as big at the end, but maybe, you know. But the question that you ought to probably be asking yourself, and I need to be asking myself, is at the end of my life, which is going to be more trustworthy? A 401k that won't run out, or the God that ultimately determines where and how I spend eternity? Which one of those actually keeps me safe? Which of those actually provides for me? I think that's a question that we ought to spend some time wrestling with as we think about the call of Christ upon our generosity and how we live our lives. Who is it that we're ultimately going to put our trust in? Because that question will determine what we do.
Well, you pose the question is you may not get ahead, and I think the question you have to ask is, what does ahead mean?
Mm-hmm.
What does ahead mean for a follower of Jesus Christ? Well, the Bible says he is the head of the church. And if I'm part of the church, then I am following him. And the point of following is to become like him.
Yeah, we have to consider, if Jesus says, I'm the way, the truth, and the life, what's his way? Well, his way ultimately led to death. And
self-sacrifice. You know, I mean, self-sacrifice, yeah, at the highest possible,
yeah,
level.
I mean, I think, JD, what you're saying, it makes me think, like, we have to start viewing blessings as not just monetary. It's not funds. I'm not blessed because my bank account's, you know, growing. Now, that doesn't mean, like, I've been on the other side of, you know, I've got more bills than I have paycheck. I've been on that side. And that doesn't lessen the pain of that. But I always find when it's times like that, that I am far more trusting in what God's doing than when I'm rolling in it.
You have to be.
Yeah.
You have to be. I mean, when you're in that situation where you're not exactly sure where the next bill is going to get paid from, or if you're going to have the money to do that, or if you've ever been in that unfortunate situation where you've had to not pay one to pay the other.
Yeah, which bill?
It's a horrible situation to be in, very difficult. But the truth of the matter is, by saying, you know what, God, I can't possibly give to you because I have this, and this, you're cutting yourself off from the capacity of God to provide for you in outrageously awesome ways. And I think you're right that we have to get to a place where we view our blessings as a lot more than how we're doing financially, even a lot better than how we're doing with our families. I think you raised the early church as an example, that Acts 2 church where they're selling and giving and taking care of one another, really are blessings. And when you think about it at its core, our blessings are those things in our lives and about our lives in which we are making life better for other people. When I am truly making a difference in the life of another person, then I am blessed. And it's got nothing to do with whether or not there's an extra zero or not an extra zero. It's how big of a difference, how big of an impact can I make on the world? And that is what proves to me that I'm both being blessed and am a blessing.
Well, and there's a joy that comes with that. I think that's why the two characters that got on the wrong side of that in Acts, in the book of Acts, I think that's what they saw, and they wanted it. Now, the way they tried to go about getting it, by faking, you know, this is everything that we've got, it was all wrong, and obviously they paid dearly for that. But there's a joy that comes when we're able to be generous, and when we rethink what we have and how we came to have it. And it comes from God, and when we see it that way, and we see ourselves as able to give and to help others, there's a joy that comes with that's contagious, I think. When a church becomes generous, it becomes a contagious thing throughout the body. And that's when things really get fun.
And one of the things I love about GNG is that commitment to being a tithing church. And I'll be honest and say that I was there when we started the original capital campaign, and we started it by giving away $25,000. And I remember being just like completely thrown by that. Like, we're about to build a building. We're about to, like, we have to, we're about to get run out of Southern State. And I don't mean that badly. I mean, like, they've asked us to find a new place to go. You know, it's their building, right? They have the right to do that. And it's like, we're going to start by, and it made me rethink my approach. It challenged me to think, you know, okay, how do I live like that? That my life would look like such generosity to the point where I'm about to go do something big for myself or my family. I better start by being generous with somebody else. You know, like, that has really challenged me and really pushed me to remember that all the fun that we can have and all the life that we can build for ourselves, or the homes that we could buy, or the cars we could buy, or the vacations we could go on, all that stuff, I'm not even going to sit here and say that's bad, because I don't think it inherently is. But when you catch that vision of what God can do through a group of people who are willing to give up anything to serve the people around them, man, that's a powerful vision for life, and it's a powerful encouragement to live differently than we naturally would.
Well, you think about when we built phase one, the first extension to our building, we estimated the cost of that extension at $250,000, and there was no hesitation in the leadership team. It's like, well, you know, we're gonna start by giving $25,000 away. And the only question was, you know, the team that decides those things, who are you giving it to? And it's fun to be able to bless, because all of a sudden you have other ministries here in town that receive a gift that they didn't know was coming. And now all of a sudden they're able to do ministry that we can't do here. We depend on them and the partnerships we have with them. And now they're able to do something, and they're saying to us, you know, thank you so much, because now we can actually do more than we had thought we would be able to do because of what you've given to us. And boy, that you talk about joy. That's when you experience a lot of joy.
Well, let me just say this. And we have a question, so before we get that, if you're listening and the thought of a church talking about money makes you recoil, I'm sorry that somebody didn't teach you right. I'm sorry that somebody hurt you on that. But let me encourage you not to avoid this series, but to dig in and to be challenged by the thoughts, to be taught in a different way, to wrestle with that. And if you are one of those people that we're talking about that's having trouble, that making ends meet and figuring out money and figuring out where it's going on, we have people here that are really good at that stuff and would love to meet with you, to talk with you. We have financial classes and things like that are all available to you that we want to help. All you got to do is email us at info@canoesgathering.org or call the office, and we'd be more than happy to get you hooked up with the right people to do that. So guys, we did have a question. that came in, and it just says this. It says, I have friends slash relatives who want to know why we at GNG preach slash study from the NIV instead of the KJV Bible. So the New International Version versus the King James Version. And I'm sure we all have something a little different to say on that. But Jeff, thoughts on that question?
Well, I'd to be honest with you, I'd like to address the word preach. Before we get into the whole King James and NIV discussion. But here at Good News Gathering, we take a slightly different approach, I guess you would say. Because most people, when they think of that word preach, they think of the person in front coming at the people in the audience. And when you use the word preach, a lot of times I think people have a kind of a negative connotation with it. We think of what we do here more as teaching. And the way we would describe that is teaching does not come at the audience. Teaching comes alongside. And let's look at what the Bible has to say about whatever the topic is. And let's learn together. And let's just look, and we'll have a discussion about this. When we actually built this building, the original architectural team that we worked with came in and observed some of our services. And one of the things that they said to us is they said, you know, when we design your new facility, one of the things we have to keep in mind is that coming to a service at Good News is like sitting down at your breakfast table and just having a conversation over a cup of coffee. And that's really what we wanted to achieve here, because that's kind of the way we feel about it. Let's just open up God's Word and let's see what it says, and let's learn together. And so we hope that the way we teach here is to come alongside people. But as far as the question about the difference and why we tend to use more modern versions of the Bible. And the NIV is just one. We also use the New Living Translation. I think on Vision Night, we used a New Century Version in one of those. And our goal in our services is to make sure that a person who walks in off the street with no background in church can understand exactly what we're talking about. And so we do look for versions that express God's word in simple, understandable language that's used today. The King James Version was produced in 1611. A lot of the language has changed since that time. Certain words no longer have the same meaning that they did then. And so what the King James presents to a lot of people in our culture today is a hurdle, a language hurdle, that they have to try and get over in order to understand what the text says. Some studies indicate that the average American cannot read at above an eighth grade level. And yet the King James Version requires a much higher level.
Higher than I have.
Yeah. Well, at times higher than I have.
just a quick example. I don't mean to interject here, but Matthew chapter 8, Jesus says, I tell you the truth. I tell you the truth. So I think we all probably understand that phrase. In the King James, that says, verily, verily, I say unto thee. There's a lot of people that aren't going to know what that word means. I mean, like, and we don't address one another as thee and thou. These are just terms that we don't use anymore. And it's not that they're inappropriate. It's not that they're incorrect. It's just these are simple terminology changes that have happened over the course of time. And it makes it really difficult for the average person walking in off the street to even understand what's going on. And when they can't get to pass the words, they can't get to the truth at the core of the passage.
Well, when's the last time you used the word verily in a sentence?
I mean, just now.
Just now, I mean, you know. Hey.
Before then?
Yeah.
Not sure.
It's funny. As most people know, I'm an Elders and Bikers for Christ. And when I stop by the shop where I get my bike worked on, a good friend of mine, who is also a member of Bikers for Christ, and there'll be people in there, and they'll always come up with debates, you know. And he always put me on the spot. Okay, Wayne, you need to tell these guys what is the best version of the Bible. What is the best version of the Bible? I say the best version of the Bible is the version that person is studying and reading. That's the best version. If you want to debate the King James Version versus whatever, that's fine. To me, it's all about, do you got a good study Bible? Do you dig it into the Word of God? And are you reading it? You know, like I said, a lot of people we got come here at G&G, if you hand them a King James Bible, go home, they're probably not going to dig into it. But you hand them NIV study Bible, or back in where you work with the kids, hand them a teen study Bible. It's going to hit right on the things the topics you talked about earlier, they're going to be hitting. And that's, you know, when we go around with Bikers for Christ, we have Bibles that we hand out that are purposely look like a biker's Bible, because that biker wants to see that Bible. It's got some chrome on the front of it, or a motorcycle, you know. They're going to dig into that versus just, you know, Bible we might have here. So,
and I think the thing that's really important for us all to recognize, and this is where Christians have to have a little bit of humility with one another, is that there is one truly inspired version of the Bible, and that was the dudes who wrote it in Greek and Hebrew and Aramaic. That is the true, unadulterated, no questions asked version of the Bible. The trouble is, I live in America and I can't speak any of those languages. I can't read any of those languages. I don't understand those languages. So we all are relying on translations. We all are relying on different versions. And you know what? If the King James works for one group of people, that's awesome. If the NIV works for another group of people, if the Message, which is a very radical almost translation, but the point is, what version of the Bible gets you into a deep and abiding relationship with Jesus? Don't foist that on somebody else. Have the humility to say, you know what? If you read best out of the King James and that's where you experience the love and the encouragement and the promises of Christ, then dig in, bro. And if not, then go find whatever version helps you take a clear look at Jesus and a clear look at what he's teaching, and then begin to apply it to your life. The translation itself, we're all reading a different version than the original, all of us. So let's have the humility to recognize that unless we're reading the original Hebrew, Greek, or Aramaic manuscripts, then we probably ought to just say, you know what? We're all reading a translation. We're all reading something like that's not the original. Have the humility to allow people to experience Jesus through those texts the way that meets them where they are.
And that's not saying you can't trust your English translation.
Absolutely not.
But I think there's just a misunderstanding about what goes into interpretation. And to understand that, textual criticism is actually like a whole field of study. You can get a PhD in it. And so to really dig in, so if you have questions, there you can take this rabbit hole real deep on where you want to go with it. But to understand, I think some people, you know, I think it's justified where they're coming from with the King James, but we get confused that we think, oh, well, it says it's the authoritative version. Well, all that means is that the King James of England gave his authority for the Bible to be translated, because you could not just do that as just a normal person. You had to have authority from the higher power to give you the right to translate that, because most people couldn't read, didn't do that. So to go from in their case, the Latin into English was a radical thing to begin with. It was really the first step into a modern language of their time. And then it kept going, you know, about 100 years later, Martin Luther came along and he translated that into German, which was huge. And so to understand the way, I mean, there's people that translated into English that ended up being burned at the stake. This is a big deal that men were trying to do this, to get what we now take for granted and collect on our bookshelves and just collects dust. Guys died to do that so that we could have a copy that we understand, so we don't have to go learn Greek or Hebrew. And I've tried, and it's difficult. And so, but to understand that, I don't think the King James has some higher regard. I think probably our English translation, modern English translations, are incredibly accurate compared to the Greek and Hebrew and the Aramaic to this day. You can trust those. Most modern translations that you're going to pick up are going to be very accurate to the original languages. And I would echo, Wayne, what you said. And I always put it this way: the best Bible to use is the one you use. It should change you. Just because you know and you've memorized it, but it doesn't change you, you start becoming an accidental Pharisee. I know a ton of Bible, but can't live it out. And I think we've all met people like that. And they know it and could win every single Bible bowl competition you put in front of them, but they have no grace for their neighbor. And the call is for us to love and point people back to Jesus. So,
you know, the one thing I think can be a little bit dangerous about that discussion, which translation works, which doesn't, which is better, which is not, the thing that, you know, and I appreciate your statement on the accidental Pharisee is it can drive us toward a lack of humility. And the Christian life should drive us to be humble recipients of the words we receive from Jesus, and people who live that out and encourage other people in our lives, in our families, in our context, to know more about Him and to serve Him themselves. That is the call of Christianity. And it's not our job to decide what version of the Bible, what translation of the Bible is going to meet a person where they are. You know, that is not our job. Our job is to help introduce them to Jesus and help introduce them to the Bible in all of the awesome and accurate and helpful translations that there are available to them. And then say, you know what? Figure out what works for you. Because if you're going to read it and you're going to get into it and you're going to fall in love with Jesus as a result, I'm good with whatever translation you're reading.
If you have further, again, yeah buts with this, we've gone a little long today, but we're so grateful if you're still with us, and we'd love to hear your questions. And if there's more clarification to the person who asked that question, feel free to, you know, pull us aside, clarify, email us, call us, whatever we can. We'd love to be able to clarify more and to help you, especially if it's for friends and relatives, to equip you to be able to answer that question around the dinner table, because we're not going to be with you. And so, again, info@goodnewsgathering.org. We hope that this has been a blessing to you. If it has, we just ask that you share it and help get the word out about Jesus more and more. We hope you have a great week.
Thanks for joining us.